Hey, everyone. Welcome to another Your Amigos podcast. Tom and I are here with Dana Rathkoff from Memorial Sloan Kettering. We're going to talk about some exciting data around an AR degrader that was presented at ASCO GU just this past weekend. So, Dana, welcome. If you want to briefly introduce yourself and then maybe kick off with sort of mechanism of this new class of drugs and sort of how they're different and what they're doing.
Sure. Thank you for inviting me today to speak on your podcast. It's exciting to finally have a seat at the table here. So I'm Dana Rathkoff.
I can't believe we haven't asked you before, to be honest.
It's just saying, it's my first time, but you know, it's okay.
I agree with you. Well, you're very welcome here, and we're looking forward to having you back.
All right. Whew. Excellent. So I'm Dana Rathkoff, and I am an attending physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I specialize in the treatment of advanced prostate cancer, and I'm excited to discuss this class of drugs. AR, or androgen receptor ligand-directed degraders, are an exciting new class of drugs that have come into clinical development over the past several years, and the way that these agents work is different from the typical androgen receptor inhibitors that we use in the clinic. Unlike the inhibitors, these degraders don't need to bind at an active binding site. They can therefore bind with a lower affinity, and this bond doesn't have to be long-lasting because the mechanism of degradation allows for this process to be recycled over time. And so the way that this class of drugs works is it's essentially a heterobifunctional molecule, which means it has two heads. One head of this molecule binds to a protein of interest, and in this setting, the protein of interest is the androgen receptor, and then it's linked to a ubiquitination molecule. In this case, it would be an E3 ligase, and this allows for proteolysis of this targeted protein within the cell.
And so, Dana, this is really it's interesting you say it doesn't need to be continuously bound, right? To put it in simple terms, sort of attaches one time and degrades, and that's it, right? Then it should be permanently degraded, or is repeat interaction necessary?
Well, repeat interaction will be necessary with androgen receptor as it's expressed within the cell, but ideally this compound that you bring in for proteolysis will be degraded.
Got it. And talk a little bit then about, you presented some data about a BMS compound at ASCO GU. So why don't you just walk us through that, and then we'll jump in with questions.
Sure. So the BMS compound is 986365. Just to maximally confuse you, it's also known as CC94676. But for the purposes of today, maybe we'll call it the BMS androgen receptor LDD, which stands for ligand-directed degrader. So this BMS AR LDD was studied in phase one, and we presented the data at ASCO. We were looking at safety and also looking for the recommended phase two dose. And there was an escalation component, which is part A, and then an expansion component, which was part B.
And you reported on both of those at ASCO,
mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay. So just walk us through the high level results.
Sure. So in the dose escalation component, what we found was that there did appear to be increased exposure with dose, but the exposure was less than dose proportionally related at higher dose levels. And so we were able to escalate up to 900 milligrams BID, and we opened up the expansion cohort looking at several dose cohorts, including I think we did a 600 milligrams QD, 400 BID, 600 BID, and 900 milligram BID dose levels in the expansion cohort. And essentially what we saw was that there was a PSA response, at particularly in a dose-dependent manner, at the higher dose levels, and that this PSA response, measured by a decline in PSA from baseline of 30% or 50%, looked to correlate with higher dose levels, and also looked like there was activity across different AR status based on ctDNA, and that included AR wild type, amplifications, and mutations.
So let's talk about maybe dose first. So it sounds like you didn't really reach a traditional MTD, right? But the PK leveled off, I think, is what I heard you say. So was there thought to even testing higher doses, or was that limited by something else?
Yeah. So in the dose escalation component and the part A component, we only saw one dose limiting toxicity. And that dose limiting toxicity was at the 900 milligram BID dose, and it was QTC prolongation. It was a grade 3 QTC prolongation. And just to re-educate on what that is typically it's if the QTC increases from baseline by 60 milliseconds or greater, or the QTC is greater than 500 milliseconds. And so this was very, very manageable. But we wanted to be careful about how we evaluated this in larger cohorts of patients, and that's why they did the expansion. And so, go ahead.
Was there any other cardiac toxicity?
I wouldn't call it toxicity. We did see bradycardia, but it was asymptomatic bradycardia and was easily managed. Was not a dose limiting toxicity.
Was that bradycardia linked to the QTC?
I don't know that it was linked in all cases, but certainly in some cases where there was QTC prolongation, we saw lower heart rates.
Does it concern you that if you develop a drug in a really common cancer that has a lot of alternatives, that having a potential cardiac toxicity, is it serious enough to pause for breath, or is this something that you can potentially just observe as time goes by? Will you be doing regular ECGs? Will you need to be doing other type of heart monitoring? Do you know how you're going to take this forward?
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom. Thank you for asking that. And I think that sort of speaks to why the company is looking at expanded dose cohorts where they're accruing more patients at different dose levels and looking at response and toxicity. Just to reiterate, there was only one dose limiting toxicity of a QTC prolongation, and it was incidentally found. It wasn't because the patient was asymptomatic. It's just because the company was being careful and monitoring EKGs as we do in these first in human compounds. And the way that it was managed was by holding the drug and then resuming. In the part B, or the dose expansion cohorts, where they expanded to approximately 20 patients per dose level, the incidence of grade 3 QTC prolongation happened in about 25% of patients at 900 milligrams BID. So that was 5 out of 20 patients. And at the 600 milligram BID dose, it was only 1 out of 20 patients, or 5% incidence. And so all of these events were, again, picked up incidentally by EKG. It wasn't because there was some sort of signal that was concerning. So it is very manageable. The question is, you know, how best to select a dose in the setting where you do have this finding.
And it looked like, Dana, that there was this QTC prolongation in that small subset that you mentioned, but at least looking at your tox table, didn't look like there was high grade bradycardia or other dysrhythmias that were a functional consequence. Is that correct?
Yeah, thanks, Brian. There weren't any significant arrhythmias that were seen on this study. And again, you know, in some ways we were monitoring so carefully with EKGs that you know, sort of speaks to the safety of the drug, and that they didn't see any significant arrhythmias. We were following these patients very closely, and even the patients who had bradycardia were asymptomatic. There were no grade 3 events of bradycardia. So I think that this is certainly manageable, but the question is how best to bring it forward into a situation where you may not be doing EKGs regularly.
I have one last, Tom, let me ask one last QT question. Tom usually interrupts me on these, so I'm kind of getting revenge here. So
excellent, go ahead.
For the patients who had QT prolongation, did they automatically stop dosing, or did you dose some patients through it, or maybe lower their dose
Right. So it was a mix. You know, this is a multi-center study. Again, sort of speaks to the fact that this is manageable. It's just a question of how best to manage it as you, you know, expand the patient numbers across maybe even more sites. But so the response to these QTC prolongations varied from holding the drug and then just resuming at the same dose to holding the drug and then lowering the dose.
Ahead, and Dana, a question for me. So are you going to expand the 900 and 600? Because 600 seems okay, but the 900 seems more complicated. Do you know enough about the 900? And with the FDA's new kind of rules about multiple dosing, getting the dosing right, How robust are you going to be regarding this issue?
Well, I mean, I think that it's important, obviously, for the company to you know, pay attention to the QTC prolongation. Again, the definitions of QTC prolongation are you know, very, very cautious, as they should be. A 60 millisecond increase from baseline, you know, the EKG that you had done the first day of treatment prior to starting, that could constitute a grade 3 QTC prolongation. And that might not be clinically significant if the QTC, for example, still remains less than 500 milliseconds. So I think that what the company is trying to understand, or, you know, that's my impression of what they're trying to understand, is sort of how, when this happens, you know, it seems like this QTC prolongation was asymptomatic, presentation, very easy to manage, and that most of this occurred within the first month or so of treatment. So I think they're trying to take that into consideration as they decide on how best to move the trial forward and which dose to use, because it does look like there's a suggestion that there's a dose-dependent efficacy rate, at least based on PSA response to the treatment.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. So I'm looking at sort of your waterfalls of PSA, and they seem to increase as you go up in dose, as you alluded to. I mean, when you're developing drugs in this space, so it was a very refractory population, how reliable is PSA change? You reported both PSA 30 and 50, and I'd seen 90. Is like, what's the right measure of PSA, or is that even the right measure? Is that reliable?
So I think PSA is a tool that we use, and I think it's certainly nice to see when it comes down. It suggests activity. You can use it as a benchmark to look at other studies in that setting. And certainly, you know, there seem to be some data that if you have a decline in PSA, that can portend better outcomes. But, you know, for me, I also tend to look at the duration of treatment. You know, we can certainly see patients that have a decline in PSA, but maybe it doesn't even reach a PSA 50 or a PSA 30, but they remain on treatment for 6 months or longer. And I would argue that staying on treatment without a lot of toxicity for a long period of time in a refractory population might be, you know, the best measure of how patients are doing on a drug. And so I think that these PSA measures are important to look at, but I also think that looking at duration of treatment is important to sort of combine with the PSA response.
Dana, what does good look like here? We didn't really talk much about the patient population. We said they were refractory. They've had LHRH agonists, they've had ARPIs, I guess. Some have had chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. One of the questions that sometimes gets asked in you know, bladder and kidney cancer field, and to some extent this is, were these patients off ARPI for a long period of time, or did they sequence directly after? And what sort of response rate would you, let's say they'd all had Abi and they get Enza instead at this setting, and that this wasn't, you know, a degrader, this was enzalutamide. What sort of response rates would you be expecting for a drug like enzalutamide if they hadn't seen that previously in this setting?
Right. So the AR switch question. The dreaded AR switch question.
Yeah, I'm afraid so.
Comes up every podcast.
So, you know, the first part of your question is, you know, I think had something to do with what the population looked like. And, you know, if we look at Part B, and that was not the dose escalation cohort, you know, certainly in the Part A dose escalation cohort, there were patients that were treated at lower doses that we moved up in quickly to sort of reach more efficacious doses. But if you look at the Part B, where we specifically selected for doses that we felt were active based on the Part A data, about, you know, approximately 50% of patients had already received both abiraterone plus an direct AR antagonist, and approximately 50% of patients had already received chemotherapy. And I think the median number of prior therapies was around 5 and ranged as high as 12. So, you know, this was certainly a heavily pretreated population. I don't know exactly what the sequence was for patients going on study. You know, some having perhaps just received chemotherapy, some having just received an AR targeted therapy, or some other investigational agent. But certainly these patients had seen a lot of other treatments and were good candidates for a clinical trial. In terms of what we might expect for patients that would otherwise go on to receive another AR-targeted therapy, maybe an AR inhibitor like enzalutamide or apalutamide or darolutamide or even abiraterone, when you look at the data, you know, some of the newer trials that are coming out and some of the historical data, probably the response or the duration of treatment for patients who go on to receive another AR-targeted therapy in this setting would be, I would say, between 3 and 6 months, depending on a little bit on the population.
And you saw to that point in
in
the 20 patients who got 900 mm-hmm. milligrams, half of them were on for at least 6 months.
Or more. And, you know, some are ongoing.
Yeah, at least 6 months.
So when we look at the duration of treatment and we look at it based on dose, at the 900 milligram cohort, there were 20 patients. And of those 20 patients, 10 were on treatment for more than 6 months. And, you know, I should mention that the median follow-up there was only 10 months. So there are some patients, you know, at that dose that maybe haven't even reached the 6 month benchmark yet. But also something that, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
No, you do also something, Dana. You keep going. I'm doing a non-interrupting.
Oh no, did I interrupt you now?
No, please don't.
I interrupted you and now you're apologizing for interrupting me. So that would be a mistake. You keep going.
Okay, I'm going to keep going. So the 900 milligram cohort, you know, another thing I just want to point out if we sort of think about the data we've been talking about so far is, you know, I mentioned that there were, you know, a number of patients that had grade 3 QTC prolongation at the 900 milligram BID dose. And some of those patients were actually dose reduced to 600 milligrams BID. You know, for the data that's been presented so far, all of these patients, even the ones that were dose reduced, are sort of bundled in to that 900 milligram BID cohort response, but some of them may have received 600 milligrams. And so I think that exploring that a little bit more will also help us to you know, think about how best to move this dose level forward.
I have a question, sort of a dumb mechanistic question. I mean, I'm looking at, look like half or three quarters of the patient got both Enza and Abby. Probably some got other AR pathway inhibitors. So why would you see activity and why would it be different than just giving them a third AR pathway inhibitor? I mean, mechanistically, what would be different?
Well, again, you know, the way that these AR ligand directed degraders work is that they don't bind at the active site, at the necessarily the same site that these other molecules bind at. And they're degrading the molecule as opposed to having to maintain, you know, inhibition. So when, you know, AR therapies or AR inhibitors are locked into that active binding site, cells can develop alternative mechanisms of resistance, such as ligand binding mutations, which, you know, can render something that used to be an antagonist, an agonist in some cases, or they can develop AR amplification or other mechanisms through other pathways of progressing. So a drug like this, where a patient maybe has been exposed to other AR inhibitors and have developed a mechanism of resistance to that, where the AR is still somehow signaling, if you use this drug, it can potentially degrade the molecule in a way that doesn't happen with other.
It just degrades the whole thing. So there's no mm-hmm. possibility for those resistance mechanisms. So you could then imagine that these would be better drugs to move earlier, yeah. Right, you know, in the big, big picture.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Diana, difficult question, I guess. If they're associated with long-term degradation and inactivation of the receptor in different states, why is resistance occurring? Because it is occurring, you know, not quickly, but it's occurring at about 6 months or before in some patients. What's the mechanism of that?
Well, I think, you know, this is a question that I think we could apply to so many compounds that we bring into the castration resistant space. You know, when you have patients that have been exposed for, you know, in some cases, a long period of time to prior AR targeted mechanisms, they develop mechanisms of resistance that can be potentially AR independent. And so it's possible that you know, some of these patients have other mechanisms of cell growth that have developed over time. So you have, you know, some initial response to this sort of AR pathway, but that there are other mechanisms that, you know, that can be fueled through, you know, PI3K pathway, for example, that are allowing for resistance.
But Dana, if you'd had Abby and Enza already, would those PI3 kinase pathways not be going like a steam train already? And this would be sort of throwing confetti in the wind.
Well, confetti in the wind. So I think that, again, you know, this is true of all drugs that we're using in this setting. And you, for, looks like from some of the data with these sort of PI3K targeted pathways, that the pathways that are activated through known mechanisms such as P10 loss, you know, might suggest patients that are more likely to develop resistance sooner relative to patients that are P10 wild type. And so, you know, that's something that's not presented yet by the company, but I know that it's something that they're looking at.
Dana, if it's degrading the receptor, why does it need to be given continuously?
So the androgen receptor is amplified. So there's not a, you know, my understanding is that it's not just, you know, one and done, right? So there's AR amplification of, which is ongoing. And so you need to continuously sort of recycle inhibiting the receptors as they're amplified or as they're developing or as the AR is signaling.
There was some work on visceral metastasis. There weren't huge numbers of patients with visceral metastasis were measured. Was there any biomarker work, and was there any sequential tissue work?
So, in terms of the visceral metastases, they were allowed in the part A dose escalation, but then in the part B dose expansion, they were, part of the exclusion criteria. And I think that kind of mirrors the previous question you had asked about resistant mechanisms. You know, if a cell has been exposed to multiple AR targeted agents, other pathways that can develop are perhaps neuroendocrine driven, and we wouldn't necessarily expect a neuroendocrine pathway to respond in the same way to AR degradation. And so to try and prevent that from happening, the eligibility for the expansion cohort excluded visceral liver metastases, brain metastases, and also required that the PSA be greater than 2, with the idea that PSA is an AR dependent protein. And so they were really trying to make sure that there was still some AR activity that would benefit from degradation going into this study. So in terms of looking at response to visceral metastases, I don't know that we'll see that in this trial, but there were baseline biopsies requested when feasible, and if not feasible, archival tissue, if available within a year prior to starting treatment, was requested. And in some cases, there were paired biopsies as well.
We did some work, a podcast with Niraj and Kim just recently. You may not have had the opportunity to listen to them yet. But there was a big debate about the presence and absence of visceral metastasis and its prognostic implications. By excluding patients with visceral metastasis, have you skewed your population to look better than perhaps it could be?
I don't think so. And I'm saying this because I think that the idea behind this particular exclusion criteria is to make sure that you are selecting, if possible, a more AR dependent population of patients, which is how you would want to sort of scaffold an AR targeted drug. You know, it's not one size fits all. And so these eligibility requirements are really difficult, I think. You know, we tried to make them generalizable to, you know, the whole population, but we do need to think about the mechanism of action of a particular drug. We don't, whenever possible, if as we learn things, we want to make sure that we're selecting patients most likely to respond. You know, I don't view that as skewing the data. I think I use that as using the data.
Tom likes to use inflammatory words like skewing. You're enriching for response.
Yeah, thank you. Enrich.
Yes, you're welcome. My last question is, you did show a patient who had at least a nodal response, but did you have bone scan responses? Was there other radiographs? I mean, this was sort of an anecdote. I don't think you presented overall response data. I understand you were focusing on PSA, but was there other radiographic responses in this cohort?
So the company hasn't presented that data yet. I know that we did do, so for example, at Memorial, we did a cohort of patients that also had PET scans, and we used FDG or fluorinated glucose and fluorinated dihydrotestosterone scans to try and understand the pharmacodynamics of the drug and tumor response. And so I suspect that they will present this data at a later date, but I don't have all of that currently. Mm-hmm.
Dana, you've got an active drug that's well tolerated in a competitive field. It was voted last year at our Euromigos meeting the most exciting new target in prostate cancer.
It was.
So how do you take this forward? Is it a combination? Is it a monotherapy really late? I guess you want to do combinations with lutetium and all the other. Where do you go next?
So I would say that the androgen receptor is a target as old as time, but to me that's always going to be an exciting target because, if patients are making PSA, I still feel that there's some degree of AR-driven disease in that setting. And so any way that we can...
Yeah, it's like whenever Liverpool plays football, I think it's exciting, but that's probably...
Isn't it though? Great, come on.
Well, no, I'm told it's not the case, unfortunately.
They'll have their day.
Apparently there were some quiet years, apparently.
I think that the AR is, to me has been, is an exciting target, will be an exciting target. I think what's most exciting about this drug is this sort of degradation component, and some of the benefits it might have over a direct inhibitor in terms of overcoming resistance mechanisms and also, treating patients that have become resistant to typical AR directed inhibitors. How we might position this drug, I'm always interested in looking at these sort of compounds earlier in the disease state, before patients have a chance to maybe develop alternative mechanisms of resistance to AR-directed therapy. And I think combinations make sense because, a lot of times, especially in this sort of metastatic castration-resistant setting, there can be multiple pathways that are activated. It doesn't just have to be the AR. So combining a drug like this would potentially be very useful. And also, I just can't help myself, Tom, have to keep going with this. I definitely think that there's, for me in my clinic, and I know this is controversial, there's a population of patients that are progressing on AR-targeted, inhibitors that aren't ready for or don't want chemotherapy yet. And, we're always thinking about where might a drug fit in that setting. I think a drug like this, where there look to be, at least at the higher doses, patients, the duration of treatment response can be extended past just a typical AR inhibitor switch, or even in the, post chemotherapy setting where, we're always looking for treatment options. I think a drug like this, which is, relatively well tolerated and has activity in a heavily pretreated population, can also be very beneficial for patients.
Yeah, Dana, I agree. These are exciting. I think I see a lot of potential to move this earlier and earlier, right? Mechanistically, it makes a lot of sense. I don't know. Tom, you have other questions? I was just going to say that.
Earlier combinations I'm cool with, but I'm just wondering about biomarkers for these therapies.
Biomarkers, it's an ongoing question, I think, for the field in general. They did do, they used the Predisin assay for cell-free DNA in this study. And I think that, as I mentioned, there's also biopsies were requested if feasible at baseline. And as they start to look at, these outcomes and match them to treatment response in terms of PSA, but also duration of therapy, it might yield some more, some better understanding of which population of patients are most likely to respond to this treatment. And in that way, the biomarkers, I think, could be very useful in terms of selecting patients for therapy. Cell-free DNA can also be used, I think, longitudinally, in terms of the amount of tumor fraction detection to see if, sort of predict how a patient's responding to treatment, maybe even better ultimately than PSA. But all of that is, as exploratory.
I've got a last question, and it's not about Liverpool Football Club's away form recently. It's actually a question about other areas and other Brian and I have seen in renal and bladder cancer companies produce very similar agents that many often end up being sort of me too, dare I say, sunitinib and sorafenib and pembrolizumab and nivolumab and all of the others.
You didn't need to mention the actual drugs, Tom.
We know the drugs. Okay. Okay. Thank you for that criticism, Brian. Is this going to be, you know, without giving away anything that's not in the public domain, is there a lot of development in this field by multiple different drugs, or is this the first drug we've seen in this environment? And is this an area which we're going to see a lot more of? Is it going to be sort of explode like a flowering garden in spring, or is this just the only drug available to us, and we're going to have to double down on this one?
So I think that thinking about all these analogies. So I think that this will, there are definitely, and I hope there are more drugs that work like this by degrading target proteins, specifically the androgen receptor. And, you know, I think that each molecule is a little bit different, you know, in the efficacy of the drug depends on sort of the linker and where the drug binds and how it binds. So, you know, it may not be that all of these drugs have the same response rate or the same toxicity. And, you know, we'll have to look at that over time to see, you know, what ultimately becomes best in class. But certainly for this drug in particular, you know, I think what's to me really exciting about it, beyond just the proof of principle in the clinic that this degradation pathway, you know, works in heavily pretreated population, you know, I think the clinical activity in terms of time on treatment and the, you know, what looks like activity across multiple different AR status types really portends, you know, some potential for this drug to move forward and be a new opportunity for patients in need of treatment.
And my last question is, were the Euromigos annual meeting right? Is this the most exciting new target in prostate cancer, or are new radioligands or bispecifics, which of those three is this the best one? Or
you've got to pick one. I'm biased. You have another hour.
You're being recorded, don't forget.
You have to pick one of the three.
I have to pick one of the
three. Yes, yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Can I use, like, be really specific? But I don't think AR is a new target. I think it's a new mechanism for targeting the AR.
Okay, the degrading group. Degrader group.
Love it.
I mean, I'm really excited about the degrading the androgen receptor in a way that, you know, I haven't been excited about, you know, other compounds in a while, but I think they all have their, I'm sorry, I have to be a little wishy-washy, Tom. I think I'm excited, like, bring it on. The more treatments that work, the better. So I'm not looking to just pick one. You know, I hope they all work.
And that gives us more opportunity. As exciting for you as anything else, with all the bias associated with, you know, of course, this is something you're developing, and we want naturally has an affinity for the drugs that you're using. But you're seeing this, you've taken part, you're seeing it work in your patients, and this is exciting for you as anything else we're doing in prostate cancer.
Oh yeah, I mean, I have a, if I can tell an anecdote, you know, I have a patient in clinic who,
Brian,
you know,
tells anecdotes all the time.
So I mean, you know, when you see a patient who's had, you know, multiple interventions, you know, they have, you know, a DNA damage repair alteration, they've received PARP inhibitors, AR target, you know, typical conventional AR targeted therapies, chemotherapy, and they come to your clinic and they're looking for, you know, a treatment option, and they're, you know, focused on getting to their daughter's wedding, you know, that summer, and you're able to offer them a clinical trial, and then you start to see, like, immediately that the PSA is declining, that they're feeling well, you know, that there's not a lot of toxicity, and you know, they send you photos from that wedding. You can't help but be excited, right? About drugs like this that offer, right?
I mean,
so I'm biased because I've seen it work.
Who doesn't love a summer wedding? Who doesn't love a summer wedding?
It's too hot though. Me, I was, you know. Too hot.
We've clearly been remiss in not inviting you on these podcasts. Yeah, we appreciate you sharing the data and your knowledge. I agree. It's as exciting as anything out there with a lot of potential. And just, I mean, my last comment is, it seems more likely than not that the drugs will be different, right? If it follows the pattern of pretty much every other class of drugs, that they're not all going to be the same. There'll be tox and efficacy differences. So not just an exciting drug, but an exciting class. So We appreciate your time today.
It depends for me a bit on when that mechanism of independence and how important that mechanism of independence is. And of course, if you go earlier, then you can
find for different patients, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there's still a lot. You know, Tom, I was just going to say, sorry. I think there's still a lot to learn. You know, this is just the first presentation of this data. And I think that, you know, looking, and you alluded to this earlier, at some of the biomarkers or some of the tissue biopsies, you know, I certainly think, as in with all treatments, there are patients that are most likely to respond to different interventions. And in any way that we can sort of hone in on that and better understand which patients are most likely to respond and optimize the dosing accordingly, you know, I think that that will certainly lend credence to this drug and overcome some of the resistance concerns. And also, you know, the median follow-up is still relatively, in my experience, it's still relatively short. For this class of drugs, there are multiple patients that are still on study and receiving treatment. So, you know, I think this story is still being told for this drug in a good way.
But even if it's short in late disease, it could be, if you combine and do much earlier, you could do a lot of cancer damage because you're testing it in a difficult place.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's I'm bought into it. You've sold it to me very successfully.
Don't be so negative, will you?
I'm being positive.
Dana, would
I'm
you like keen... to go host a podcast with me?
I'm keen to do the next.
And I don't vote for Liverpool, Brian. Does that help? Is the job open to me? But
totally, 100%. All right. Hey, Dana, thanks for your time.
Okay, this has been fabulous.
We'll see you soon.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.